This week on Writers, Inc.
I feel it out as I go. I'm just one of those writers. I never meant for any of my series to be series, but my characters do grow on me, and then I can't let them go. I think Frankie has more stories to tell, but I also need to even plot the books. Like, I learn the book as I go.
J.K. Rowling was nearly homeless when she wrote the first Harry Potter book. Stephen King penned Carrie in a small desk wedged between a washer and dryer. James Patterson worked in advertising and famously crafted the Toys R Us theme song long before becoming an author. Join New York Times bestseller J.D. Barker and a panel of industry powerhouses as they pull back the curtain on some of the world's most prolific authors. Where did they start? What is their process? The biggest names in publishing all have origin stories. All have tips and secrets. What does it take to consistently top the bestseller lists and become a household name? Get your notepad out. School's in session. This is Writers, Inc.
Hi, it's Christine Daigle.
I'm Jenna Brown.
J.P. Reinflesh.
It is J.D. Barker. No, it is not. This is J. Kevin Tomlinson. J.D.'s not with us.
No, he's building a surprise treehouse for his daughter, which is actually a pretty good reason not to show up.
Yeah. I guess.
He's just going to build a treehouse in a day.
Yeah.
Oh, he got the robots to do it.
I know, but he does that. He built all his bookshelves, and I'm kind of jealous.
He does have an army of robot slaves working for him, though.
Yeah. Like
robot dog, robot snowblower. Mm-hmm. I forget the list. We need to make a list.
We do.
They'll all be like circling around the treehouse, just doing their part.
When AI takes over, JD's going first.
Yeah, every 24 hours, we need to check in with his robots, make sure that they haven't taken over his house.
Make sure it's not cloudy, because otherwise the one will just go rogue and start mowing somewhere else.
You never know.
Yeah.
Well, we got listener feedback today.
We did. Yeah, we had a lot of thoughts when we talked about the email spamming that is going on now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The stuff that's obviously coming from AI, or at least they're using AI to do it. But Adam says that most likely what's happening is businesses are using agent mode in ChatGPT, and basically you can tell it to find every fiction author writing thrillers, find their email address, and send them an email highlighting call outs from their books and offer XYZ service. And the AI will then go and do all the work for the quote business. I haven't used agent mode yet. Have any of you used that?
I haven't. But this makes so much sense because I have had the same string of messages. And so, yeah, this makes a ton of sense.
My favorite is when they send you the same one twice in the same day, three times.
Or you get it. I'm getting a lot of voicemails right now that are the same AI voice that uses a different name, but gives me the exact same message and calls from a different number.
Yeah,
But it's always a different name. Hi, this is Claire. This is Charlotte. This is Joe.
It's the same voice.
But it's the exact same. Everything's the same except for the name.
Yeah. I mean, my spam on my just on my phone has increased too. Like, we've got you speeding on radar. Please pay this ticket.
Oh, yeah, I get a lot of those too.
I know. My favorite is that they tell you that they're from, you know, like the Nevada DMV and then has like an India country code. And you're like, I can believe a lot of things. I do not believe that.
I got one from the Harris County Toll Authority. And the reason I get them from there is because I kept my mobile number from when we moved up from Houston. Mm. So I get them from that area. But then when I look closer, it says to contact the New Jersey Toll Authority. And then it gives a New Jersey number for me to call, or gives me, you know, something. But They haven't perfected this yet.
No,
I've been getting this one where this female voice will start and then she'll pause and clear her throat. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, oh, this one. I got to cut this one. And so like there's like these weird human things that they keep adding to them. Yeah. And every time I hear it, I'm like, OK,
it's funny. I just got that one this morning. That's funny.
How do we make Press the nine. Robot sound more human? You know what? Let's have them pause. Let's have them clear their throat.
They should have an emotional breakdown on the phone. Why won't you ever return my call?
Kevin.
Now that's a voicemail I would keep.
I would keep that one. They might even get a call back from me on that one, frankly.
Maybe.
We got another one here from Sam. Sam shares that there are broker removal services that can make spam nearly non-existent.
Yeah. And JD emailed in, even though he's not here, that he Googled his email address with quotes around it.
Yeah.
And then that gave him every place it appears publicly. So he's currently getting someone to take those down.
So I did that right after he sent that.
Yeah.
And it was sort of eye-opening, where I guess I learned some interesting things about myself in doing that. I object to the broker services, though, because I think that they, I don't know, I'm just enough of a tinfoil hat guy to think that they are out there creating the problem that they're offering to solve in exchange for money.
Smart business.
And Jenna agrees with me, even though she's about to object.
I'm not going to object. I do think that there probably are some of those services that do that, but some of them, I think, work. So I just think that you have to like research if you're going to use one of those services and make sure that it's a legitimate one, because it is very easy to like just create ongoing business. Like, man, we just can't get your email off the internet. I don't know what to do. That's a very easy thing that I think a lot of people wouldn't question, but I do think there are like legitimate services. Like my friend uses one and they have like a guarantee where it's like if you show up on the same places, they refund your money, or I don't remember exactly how the guarantee works, but she did it and she didn't have a single spam email for like 2 years. So, and it wasn't like an ongoing subscription. It was like she paid for a service.
Yeah.
I'll have to see which one she used. They're still in business.
Speaking of stories, we have some news.
We do.
Can roll right into. First up, Associated Press ends weekly book reviews. The Associated Press alerted its freelance book reviewers that the outlet would be ending its weekly reviews starting September 1st. The AP will, quote, continue covering books as stories, which will be handled by journalists on staff. The memo reads, unfortunately, the audience for book reviews is relatively low, and we can no longer sustain the time it takes to plan, coordinate, write, and edit reviews.
Another place losing book reviews. It always makes me sad.
Yeah.
I almost, this is just the millennial in me, I don't know. I almost think that why aren't they using more social media platforms to push their reviews? We have reviewers on places like TikTok who are getting paid because they're posting reviews and people are viewing them. And so why not have like an Associated Press platform and do your best to build it up, but then have these sorts of reviews as the secondary for the posts? Like, why not get with the times?
I think you've hit on something,
yeah.
JP.
That, you know, the only thing I think of sometimes, and I understand why it gets harder and harder, because like you can't believe anything on social media these days. But conversely, that's where all the people are. So
yeah,
traditional places that would have legitimate book reviews that aren't just necessarily going to be like, this is the best book you've ever read in your entire life.
Yeah.
Who are actually going to offer critique on books, just don't have the audience. But then it's also very dangerous to just go to social media, because I don't believe anything I see on social media anymore. Like, even with like bookstagrammers that I really like, there's very few that I actually trust to give an opinion, especially the bigger they get, because the bigger you get, you know, if you want to keep working with people, you can't give negative reviews. So they just don't review the books that, you know, and I don't know
well,
what the answer is.
Okay.
It's
so you, you don't trust social media, but I will say I would give social media my driver's license number and social security number before I would trust mainstream media. So AP has lost a lot of its audience because it can't be trusted. So, you know, that stuff
Everything
goes
I
away.
Look up on social media is a lie. I'm like, this is a cool fact. And then I look it up and it's totally bogus.
Listen, I'm not like advocating for mainstream media, because like, listen, like three people own all of the news sources globally. Like, that's a problem. It's just, I guess though, when it comes to book reviews, you're and it's not 100%. Like, listen, like people pander in the New York Times all the time, right? Like you read a New York Times book review and you're like, this is bullshit. Like that person, it's a bought and paid for ad, and you know it is.
You know what we need?
You get it less than social media, I think.
We need to crowdfund a book reviewer that will just give their honest opinions from readers, not from any companies. I would
Yeah.
just let's just subscribe. Tell me what you think.
I know. Well, it's hard because that's supposed to be Goodreads, but Goodreads, you can, review bomb and you don't have to have actually even have even touched the book. So I don't know. It's a weird problem. I don't know that there's an answer.
I actually think, Christine, that's an interesting solution
See?
because if you think about it, if you had, let's say that we created a group that only made profit when the crowd funded them to write, to do the reviews, write and read, produce video and whatever. That would mean that if they did not follow through, do an honest job, stay above board, the crowd would slowly start pulling away. If they weren't providing what the crowd was funding, the funding would leave, and so they'd go under. That's the
I would
best
do
kind of
that. I would pay a
democracy.
couple bucks a month for a book reviewer to give completely honest reviews of genres that I
Not
like.
sensationalized, not over the
I
top,
think we
just
got a business,
honest.
Kevin. Let's get
We
on
got
it.
it.
One of the things I liked about the StoryGraph app, which hasn't taken off, but it has more options than just a star rating. And I feel like when we start to filter everything into one singular rating, it makes it very difficult for people to argue if something is good or bad because it becomes sort of binary or on a linear line. Whereas, like on StoryGraph, you can say, like, yeah, this didn't have a strong character forward, but it was more plot driven. Maybe it's not the thing I like. And so then you can go with that in your review. But having that sort of like, these are the things that you can tick off, and these are the things that you can then have as your rating for your book. I almost feel like that is where reviews should head towards, because especially in the social media platform, it is really difficult for you to give a bad review. But if you're able to have more options as to say, this one particular thing is not for me, therefore I'm not rating it high, I think that gives more space.
Yeah, that is an interesting
Well,
one star books. That's a great way to find out if you want to read a book. One
yes.
star reviews.
Right. All right. Well, speaking of things to tick off, I'm going to read the next story. Publishers, authors win Florida book banning suit. A federal judge blocked key parts of Florida's HB 1069, which had yanked books from, quote, describing sexual content, including On the Road and The Bluest Eye, ruling the law overbroad and the targeted books not obscene. I have to agree. The court affirmed that the First Amendment applies in school libraries. Books can only be removed if, taken as a whole, they lack serious literary, artistic, political, or scientific value. The judge rejected one size fits all removals for all minors and struck the vague, quote, "I know it when I see it" standard, reinforcing librarians and educators' role in selecting titles. Publishers and the Authors Guild called it a sweeping tight right to read win. The state is expected to appeal.
I think that's a good thing. Less
Yeah.
censorship is always good, so good for
100%.
them to get a win.
I do, and I know maybe I'll take some flack. I don't know, whatever. But I mean, I do agree with, you know, we should be monitoring what the level of sexualized content that goes to children under certain ages, or maybe just children even all the way up to 18 when they're still in high school. I think that we do have content in school libraries that to me crosses the line. But then again, I'm not the guy who makes the rules for the whole world. So the parents should have a say in that. And the people selecting the titles should be able to make a case for it. And beyond that, I think we get way too much overreach. I am opposed to government, so as a libertarian. So I would like as little government intrusion in my schools or anything else as I can get.
I don't know that we need ACOTAR in school libraries. On the other hand, I don't know that it's anyone's responsibility except for the parents to parent. And I always feel like if you don't know what your kids are reading, like that's a you problem. And I know that sounds really aggressive, but I, was reading a lot at a tender young age. And my parents had no clue. But they never asked. They were just like, oh, great, she's got her face in a book. And I turned out fine. But
Exactly.
look how great we are.
yeah, but you know, when it came to raising my own son, you know, it was very important to me to have open, honest communication with him and to check in with him and to see what he was doing and what he was reading. And kids, I think if it's not in the school library, they're gonna get it somewhere else. Like, I guess
I would,
that's the
yeah,
thing about kids.
I'd like to just throw in here that when it comes to public libraries, I think it should be hands off altogether. There shouldn't
Yeah.
be any of this. But I do the I do have I do kind of take issue with public school libraries or any school library. But the parents do have
Well,
a huge responsibility to know what their kids are reading. Not
yeah,
always made easy,
like
but
I said, I don't know that I'm really on board for the argument that ACOTAR needs to be in a school
right.
library. Like,
It's
I
tough
mean,
though.
Yeah.
It's tough though, because like a lot of this was targeted towards queer content that was not inherently
yeah,
sexual, but it
yeah,
was made sexual by people who wanted it banned
right.
because like the lifestyle is sexual and it's inherently not. So it's really tough to decide where that line is. But I think that like if there was a way to sort of have a book say what content is within it without necessarily banning or whatever, and having that be, this would be such a process, but to have it be that if you go to check this book out and it contains XYZ and the parent doesn't want that, then that can be like, oh, you can't check this book out. Like that could be a way around it that I think would be a smarter approach. It would just take more time and effort.
And that, yeah, that's on the shoulders of the librarians and the people selecting the titles. They, if they're going to select a title, they should be willing to defend it, is what I'm trying to say. Like they should be able to explain the same way, you know, if you, what's the quote from Einstein? If you couldn't explain it to a 10-year-old, then you don't understand it. Like, so if you can't explain this to the, you know, to the kid or to the parents what the content is, then you haven't looked at it, you haven't read
Yeah,
it.
I think I do agree. I do think that they target certain books, you know, just basically like, oh, you know, heavens to Betsy, this is going to ruin the children. But like, can we just also pause and say, like, classics are horrifying on like 10 million levels. Like Lord of the Flies is
Oh man, that's my
like,
favorite. That was my
but you know, that's approved content. So I
yeah.
guess sometimes too, I get a little irked at people who are just like, but what will this do to the children? And it's
But
like,
there's
if you
nothing
traumatize
sexual
me
in
in
Lord of the
fourth
Flies.
grade,
It's
then
all
you can
murder.
read Reference
Violence is
Rose.
fine. We love murder.
We've
Fighting.
established that all violence is fine in every form.
Violence is fine.
It's not fine.
Speaking of violence, AI industry warns that new lawsuit could destroy it entirely. A federal judge let authors sue Anthropic as one big class covering about 7 million books the company allegedly pulled from pirated libraries, exposing it to damages that could reach hundreds of billions, up to $150K per book. Anthropic rushed to the appeals court, saying the case is a death knell, that there's no reliable way to even identify all class members, and that the pressure would force a settlement before it can defend itself. AI firms keep arguing that training on copyrighted works is fair use, and that paying for everything would sink the industry, while critics say the model is built on mass permissionless scraping. However, even some author advocacy and digital rights groups say copyright cases are a bad fit for class actions, since ownership and licenses vary title by title, making this class look overly broad. I happen to agree with that last statement. This is a terrible class action. It's going to go nowhere, and it's going to damage the industry more than it helps. I can get into more detail on that in a bit.
No, it's an interesting one. Just they're like, we can't possibly reach out to everybody we stole from. I don't know.
Everyone we stole from.
It's a
See,
pretty
I don't.
the
It would be such
anti-AI
a long
argument is
list
pretty
to.
wild to me. Like Like the what they do is like, well, but we did it and we can't undo it, so deal with it. It's like,
Can't
wow.
unring the bell.
Okay.
Yeah, I think there is a little bit of that in there. There's also some, not just because they have a book in their, I don't know, what are you going to call this, their library of resources that they trained on, actually doesn't prove that it was stolen either. And so there's
Yeah.
that problem to contend with. How often have, especially in the self-publishing circles, a lot of books end up floating around out there
Yeah,
for
for sure.
free.
Yeah.
And I know from personal experience that a lot of titles were scanned from Smashwords, which was offering free titles. So, it's just a there it's too there's too it's too messy. And I
Yeah.
think that they're not doing anyone any favors by going so hard after this. I have a hard time really kind of getting my head around why a federal judge would have allowed this. I mean, to me, it fails every metric for copyright violation that I've ever encountered. So I'm watching it because it's interesting, but I do think ultimately it's just going to fall to pieces.
Yeah. All right. I guess with that, I better.
Told you I had more to say about it.
You have a story. Share it with the world. Ingram Spark offers everything you need to publish, promote, sell, and print your book. Reach millions of readers worldwide with powerful tools created for independent authors. Get started for free at ingramspark.com/learn more.
So, up this week, it is Lisa Gardner. She's a number one New York Times bestselling author of over 20 suspense novels. Her novels often feature characters from her various series, including the FBI Profilers, Detective D.D. Warren, and PI Tessa Leone. She's also the author of the Frankie Elkins series, which follows an average woman who specializes in finding missing people. So here she is, Lisa Gardner. Okay, Lisa Gardner, this is, I believe, your third time joining us. So welcome back.
Thank you, Christine. It's always a pleasure to be on a show about writing.
Yeah, so you have a new book out, Kiss Her Goodbye, which we're going to talk about in a little bit. But since we have a lot of writers listening, I'm curious. Your last visit was a few years ago. How do you think things have changed in publishing, in the publishing landscape?
Oh, it's interesting. I've been in publishing 35 years, and I feel like particularly the last probably 5 years, it's become the wild, wild west.
Yeah.
And there's good news about that. There's more books, talent that's able to bubble up. It's also a lot of madness. And it's interesting. We're always such a staid industry. And now I feel like none of us know what's going to happen next. We've just gone from one extreme to the other.
Yeah, I feel like there's been a lot of shifts. Like probably 5 years ago, the wisdom was, social media doesn't sell books. Do you feel like that's changed or?
Marketing is my weakness and will always
Yeah.
be my weakness. I mean, I'm a writer's writer, and to a certain extent, I mean, I'm a big part of the International Thriller Writers, organizations like that. We should have some working knowledge of our industry because we're in it. But on the other hand, I feel like the one thing that's never going to change is books. People are going to want to read. They're going to want to read great stories. The only thing I really know how to do is write. So I just try to put on my little blinders and stay in my lane and just survive the madness outside
Oh, I love
the
that. I just feel like in the last 5 years, authors are being asked to do more. So I'm always curious,
Oh,
what are you
so
being asked to
true.
do that maybe 5, 10 years ago you didn't have to do?
I mean, more the marketing is on us.
Yeah.
But having said that, I think none of us know whether that works or doesn't work. And so, in terms of what I can do at the end of the day is, focus on the book.
Perfect. I like that. Maybe don't sweat it too much. Nobody knows what's going on.
Yeah, really.
Yeah, so I'd love to talk about your latest book. I just finished it yesterday, so this is perfect.
Oh, yeah.
So Kiss Her Goodbye is the fourth Frankie Elkin novel. And
Yes.
I was really curious just about the character of Frankie, because Frankie is a drifter. She solves cold cases, no money, no recognition. no help. And I just thought that it's a brilliant kind of premise that lends itself to endless stories. Was that something that you thought about at its kind of conception before you wrote book one?
I'm not very good at looking ahead, I'm going to be honest. I will say, again, as someone who's been around a long time, 35 years, I do get bored and restless. You know, I started my career when it was all FBI profilers all the time. Yeah. And then we had Criminal Minds and we had serial killers in our living rooms every week. And it's like, there's just, I have nothing new to say here. Nothing new I can add. So then I got this idea for a book that would be like a city detective. And it's like, oh, I don't know actually profilers. I don't know urban detectives. So that was really fun. But then at a certain point, you're also like, all right, this has been like 12, 13, 14. I mean, I'm running out of things to say here. And I do read a lot of nonfiction and things in the news. And that's what brought Frankie to my attention, that we have another trend in, again, real life kind of law enforcement, for lack of a better word, of because of the information age and all these cold cases, getting more and more armchair detectives. I mean, think of it. It's probably us and some of our readers even that, you know, we do think maybe we could add some value or solve some of these cold cases. And there are real life Frankies out there. And that got me, okay, so now what it would be like to try to work a case, find a missing person when you have no background at all, but you also don't have support. Like you don't have a police shield to get you in places. You don't have forensics to back you up. You have no authority at all. What would this look like? And that was endlessly fascinating to me. And then I knew I had a book.
Yeah. I mean, that's true. Like we have so much information. We can Google so many things. If you're a little bit more talented computer wise, you probably can even access more things, but then, yeah, you don't have that police access. That's really interesting. I didn't think about that. What kind of challenges did that make for you, like creatively? Because I know in this book, she's kind of ahead of the police in some cases. She's at the crime scenes first. Is that the way you're usually going about it, or how do you tackle?
It really varies.
Yeah.
This book is the most timely, quick cases Frankie's ever worked on. I mean, the woman, a young mother, and a refugee who's only been in the country for 10 weeks, you know, has gone missing under mysterious circumstances, but only for a matter of weeks. I mean, Frankie's very first case, we met her, the teenager had been missing a year.
Yeah.
So yeah, Frankie seems ahead of the curve on this one because no one else has really taken an interest at all. But again, Frankie's not law enforcement. What I've really liked, I'm very character driven. So part of it was, okay, if I'm going to do, you know, a person who's really kind of doing this maybe more out of obsession, you know, though the classic throwback to the lone gunman going from town to town to right the wrongs, I really wanted to lean into it. Like Frankie is not physically gifted. You know, she's been compared to Jack Reacher because she wanders from town to town, but she's not winning a bar fight. She's not a hacker. I feel like that's often almost, I don't want to besmirch her, but kind of a crutch. Oh, there's just some algorithm, something, and then we have all the answers and anything we ever wanted. I mean, Frankie really does not have a skill set. I mean, if you're going amateur sleuth, you know, lean in heavily. Not even arcane knowledge, like I read and remember everything I read. She's adaptable and she's empathetic.
Yeah.
I think Frankie is a character study in how some of her biggest mistakes and personal failings have become her strengths. She is a recovering alcoholic. She, you know, spent her time down in the gutter. Her experience with law enforcement is being on the other side of the bars and having made a lot of mistakes, having bottomed out. Frankie doesn't judge. And Frankie can go from place to place and talk to loved ones, which when you read about cold cases, they generally are end up solved by someone asking the right question at the right time. That Frankie can do. And it's just committing to that as the construct. Frankie can't suddenly miraculously know how to do something now. I mean, she's asking, she's listening, she has a good sense of people. who's telling the truth and who isn't.
I like that because I did think a little bit. I'm like, oh yeah, it's that Jack Reacher concept that lends itself to I can tell any story I want anywhere I want, which is great for longevity of a series when you're kind of a drifter. But yeah, she's not a 6'4" muscular guy. She's not winning any fights. She could be anybody, right? Which is the beauty of her.
And I did love the wandering element. So I thought you kind of had to do it too. But because, I've just come out of writing the Dee Dee Warren books that I loved, but a Boston cop. So Boston, and thank heavens I love Boston, but it has been refreshing to suddenly I can go anywhere.
Right, anything I want. So, yeah, you like you said, Frankie is in Tucson for this, and she's looking for a missing Afghan refugee. What drew you to tell this story about this young mother who is haunted by war and kind of trying to start over?
Yeah, most of my books have been ripped from the headlines in some ways. I'm one of those authors. I get up every morning and read like all the curious news or crazy stories. Just there's ideas everywhere. But in this case, I also met a couple that this is what they do for their volunteer work. They help resettle refugee families in Tucson. And in particular, when I met them, they just started working with an Afghan family. And getting again to that nuts and bolts, like I thought I knew what a refugee was. I thought I knew what, okay, they come to the US and I don't know, it works out. But to hear what goes into this and that you legally have 90 days, 90 days to get up and established and running in the United States, generally in urban environments where there's no affordable housing. Most of the time, even if you have a professional or educational background, it will not be honored in this country. So you are going to be Uber Eats. That's just or housekeeping or landscaping, like that is what you're allowed to do. You might have been a lawyer, a doctor, an engineer, but nope, this is now what your life is going to be. And talking to them about all of that, and then talking to some of the refugees themselves, that really deep human experience where this is so hard. And yet at the same time, the refugees I spoke to, they are so grateful. This is the best shot at a future and safety for their children and their family. So it doesn't matter that it feels impossible. They will figure out how to get it done. And our country remains a beacon of hope, which it was sometimes it's nice to hear that story too.
It is it's a difficult thing. I know you interviewed refugees for this book, right? So that must have been an emotional process. Like I know sometimes it can be kind of, I deal with some of this in my work as well, and you kind of get sometimes a little bit of secondary trauma, just from hearing their stories. What stayed with you from these conversations, or was there anything that you learned that was surprising?
The most remarkable story I had was talking to a young female who in Kabul worked for the Ministry of I'm sorry, Women's Affairs, women's rights. And I mean, like a lot of Americans, I kind of think of other countries sometimes, and like Afghanistan as, being over there and maybe backwards, like poverty, rural, dust bowl, that kind of stuff. But I mean, there are aspects like any country, but Kabul was, it's been a major trade city and capital city for thousands of years. So I'm talking to this young woman who's like, oh yeah, the day Kabul fell, just completed some groundworking, breaking legislation on anti-harassment laws to protect women's rights in the office on a Sunday, in her cubicle with the coffee she got at the corner coffee shop, checking Facebook. One gets this call, you need to turn on the news. And then, like shortly after that, you need to get home. And within 8 hours, it was gone. It was over. And she was just like, I mean, yeah. I mean, they knew that the Taliban was making a resurgence. They knew there was, but it's like sitting in New York City. Oh, somewhere out in the countryside, there's some stuff going on, but it's New York City. I mean, that doesn't apply to us. And just the sheer bewilderment, the trauma, a young woman who, has never left her parents, never lived on her own. She could be evacuated because of her job made her a target. Her parents, the rest of her family could not. So on her own for the very first time in a foreign country, I cried at the end of talking to her. She did too. Like it's very real. And I'm used to research being more procedure driven. This was a lot more, I felt like I had to be more Frankie.
Yeah.
Just talking to people about their experiences and letting them talk.
Yeah. 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 Really. That's interesting because you're more procedurally driven. And then do you find like, so you're coming to this place, you've had this shared human connection experience and emotion, and then you're putting that into your work. Is that harder when you're writing from an emotional place than kind of a procedural place?
I think so. I mean, there's a lot of experiences too, and you're kind of like, what do I honor or what do I pick and choose from? The research itself was also different when you're, you know, when you're talking to someone about their job, you can sit there and take copious notes. When you're starting to have what's turning out to be a very emotional, in-depth conversation, well, I mean, you're not recording because that's off-putting to people, but you kind of feel like you have to put the pen down.
Yeah.
So I'm also having to accept that later I'm going to come at this also very inexactly. It's going to be more my perception or I remember of this conversation versus, again, like, okay, you know, insert widget A into widget B to find footprint. I don't know, kind of thing. And you have to be, but that's okay because I'm not trying to capture a specific. I'm trying to capture a sense of what this very, very intense experience is like.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's not easy. And to infuse that emotion, you know, and that very rich experience with thrillers, which you have to keep up the pacing as well, right? Like thrillers, pacing is king.
Yes.
So sometimes it's difficult to balance, like, here's this war and this immersive experience that you want people to have while keeping up pacing. How did you kind of tackle that without, you know, overwhelming with details and
I think the first rule of writing a thriller, and really when you want to get into, you know, what makes something a page turner is you always need to be increasing the stakes and you always need to have a lot at stake. And honestly, the experiences I'm hearing from these people, you want to talk about going through a life where everything is at stake. So in that way, these things dovetail together very well. I mean, I'm listening to people talk to what are very sadly in the real world, incredibly dramatic, traumatic experiences. But if you're writing a character-driven thriller, which is what I'm always trying to do, it lends itself inherently to that process.
Yeah.
You know, when every single thing is on the line, how far would you go to save the ones you love? And I just kind of kept that in my mind as I went.
Yeah, that's great. That's great insight. And then you said this, so you've got this dark subject matter and this, then you said it in sunny Tucson, which was an interesting choice for setting. And I know you do a lot of travel, and I'd love to hear about your settings and your travels and how that comes into your work. Lighten it up a little bit now.
Well, I chose Tucson because the couple I met, that's where they live and work. So they were kind of my entry point, and they were gracious. I met them on a trip. And they end up taking me all around Tucson. They introduced me to the resettlement agencies, some of the families that they had done work with. So it was amazing. But again, like a lot of research things, I didn't really know Tucson. I mean, I know Phoenix. I'll be there tomorrow for a book signing. I can't wait at the Poison Pen, which is amazing.
Oh, very
but
nice.
I didn't really know Tucson. And it really is such a multicultural, international city, partly because we have one of our largest Air Force bases there. So you have these service people who've been all around the world and they're bringing that home with them. And while we all, I think, have some knowledge of the Afghan interpreters we've been bringing back to the United States. I mean, service in general are assisted with people, locals on the ground, and often end up, you know, helping with the immigration process to the United States. So you end up with a city that has, you know, people from everywhere and this incredibly diverse food scene. They're a gastronomic city honored by like the United Nations, something crazy. And I got to go eat Afghan food because, you know, research is very, very important. And I know the more I learned, the more dazzled I was. And I feel like when you're a writer, that's when you know you're onto something. Like, if this is so interesting and so compelling to me, well, hopefully it will be for readers as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And definitely the food came across that I wanted to try, the pistachio rose custard
dessert. Bernie pudding. Yes. The recipe is, it's going to be in the reader's guide, and it's on some places online. But yes, I ate that with my fingers in a hotel room, and it was the best experience.
That sounds delightful. I'm a big fan of food and fiction, and that just evoking that and be like, oh, I really want to try that. That sounds delightful. So I know you do travel a lot. What other kind of like experience? I was reading in your acknowledgments just all the places you have been and how that has come into your writing. And I would love to hear more about some of those experiences and how that inspires you.
Well, I think if you're a novelist, inspiration really is everywhere, or that's the kind of the key to never running out of ideas. And I do love to travel. I mean, if I'm already writing a book, I might be traveling specifically for that. But in between, I do a lot of what I call it just replenishing the whale.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, sometimes I get no specific idea out of it at all. But sometimes I go to a place like the Palmyra Atoll, which ended up being Still See You Everywhere. That was last year's book with Frankie Elkin, because it was so remote and dangerous and isolated that the minute I was there, it's like, oh, this totally has to be used for murder and mayhem. It's just too good not to. Sometimes it's meeting people on a trip that do this phenomenal, either a real world job or volunteering or experience, or just have a story to tell. I mean, I don't know about you, but I think I do generally enjoy just asking people questions and just learning what their stories and what they have to say. And it's very rare to walk away from that without like, oh, this could be fun in a book.
Yeah. No, I like what you said there about replenishing the well, because you need to socialize and have new experiences. I mean, as writers, we have good imaginations, right? But that inspiration has to come from somewhere. Do you write constantly, or do you take kind of breaks where you're like, I need a creative break and I just need to go do things just for the sake of doing them and having different experiences?
I generally will take a small break between finishing one book and starting the next. If I can time it right, I will generally go off. Because that's the other thing. I work out of my home.
Yeah.
So it's hard for me to relax at home. Like if I'm just going to sit around home, well, then I'm going to start working again, because it's almost like a conditioned response for, I guess, good reasons. But so if I truly, truly am going to go on vacation, I need to go.
That's nice. How much time is a small time between books? What do you usually take off?
It'll really vary. Sometimes if I already know what I want to work on, I'll take a break and then start the research process, because that's kind of fun.
Yeah.
You know? And sometimes it's, I don't quite know what I want to do yet. So I'll take more time, because you want the right idea. I don't want to rush it. You'll know when you have the right idea and when you're excited, then you're ready to go again.
Yeah.
If it's like, oh, I have to write something. Oh, I'll just do that. I don't think a good book will come from that. At least not for me.
Yeah. You have to have something you're really excited about, whether it's 3 days or 3 weeks or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Fantastic. So this is your fourth book, and I'm imagining, is this going to be a long-running series, the Frankie Elkin? How many books do you see it having, or do you just kind of feel it out as it goes?
I feel it out as I go. I'm just one of those writers. I never meant for any of my series to be series, but my characters do grow on me, and then I can't let them go. I think Frankie has more stories to tell, but I also need to even plot the books. Like, I learn the book as I go. So like where I ended with this book, it's like, oh, I got to think about that for a second for Frankie. Like, because that's the other thing I think when you're committing to writing, again, an amateur, a non-professional, Frankie's choices have to have real consequences for her. I mean, poor Detective Dee Dee Warren, I tried to kill every single novel, but she's a hardened detective. She can take it. <You know? laughs> For Frankie, that's not what she thought this was going to be. It was just, you know, they're cold cases. They're missing persons. They're not supposed to be scary and, you know, death-defying, you know. And so when things get really, really intense, Frankie has to, that has consequences for Frankie. And I want to be real to that for where Frankie starts the next book.
Yeah. So do you decide when a series is done, or do you leave it open? Is it kind of like,
I've never decided one is done.
Never decided one is done. As long as it's fun, you're going to keep on.
Well, and I do bring characters back. Yeah. So it's not necessarily linear. I have a feeling from a marketing perspective that would be better for my career if I was linear. You know.
Oh, but we let the marketers worry about marketing.
Yeah. I think it'd be fun if Frankie and Dee Dee Warren met sometime in Boston.
There you go. Is that what, besides Frankie, is that
what's it's in the back of my head.
Back
and,
of your
and
head.
So eventually I think it will happen. But it's like coming up with the right circumstance kind of thing. So yeah, never say never. There's always one more adventure out there.
Yeah. So I'm curious, within that, like looking forward, what's lighting you up right now? What's feeding your creative well, sparking your imagination?
I do like to change things up because I think it, again, it reignites my enthusiasm, which I hope makes for a better book.
Yeah.
I started way in the beginning, really, with domestic thrillers. And I've always been a huge fan of the gothics. And, you know, there's certainly a trend we're seeing come back now. And so I had this idea for a mysterious young couple buying this ramshackle lodge up in the mountains of New Hampshire that happens to be the setting of a major unsolved crime. And, you know, there's rumors of ghosts and there's townspeople who clearly are harboring secrets. And it's just been a lot of fun to get back to those kind of the basics of nothing in this town, nothing with these people is what it seems. And the dog, even the dog knows things, but I don't know what.
Well, if it's gothic, it could be anything the dog knows.
Yes, that's right. The stray dog named Dog is very important.
Yeah, that is important. That's fantastic. Well, just as we're coming to a close, I just want to ask a question we like to ask everyone. If you had advice for newer or aspiring writers right now, what would you say to them?
Well, the standard advice is like read and write. Yeah. But the other thing I will say is I've really appreciated being a member of writing organizations. Mm-hmm. Like now I'm on the board with the International Thriller Writers. And just, I mean, it was actually one of my fellow authors that helped me with some of the research for this book. He had served in Afghanistan and he brought me some contacts to the table. So we are collegial sort. Yes. But I think spending time with other people who have the same fears and insecurities and what do you mean? What, now I'm doing a TikTok reel and what the hell's going on here? And oh yeah, let's talk about the voices in my head. It's just, it's comforting. It is a source of comfort.
Yeah.
As you embark down this crazy road.
Yeah, I think that's always great advice. Like, I really think the author community is very generous and you can find your people to help you along the journey. So
we're never going to know everything we're supposed to know or feel like we should know. So just meeting other people who are as lost and confused as we are, it's helpful.
So when I was talking to Lisa, when I read the book, my thought was a comparison to Jack Reacher. And she said she gets that a lot. Although her character is just a normal person who's not 6'4" with massive muscles and military skills. But I'm just wondering, when you are starting a book, do you think about series potential, like longevity of that character?
It depends on the story. Like, I have a couple ideas that right now are like firmly standalone. Like, when I think of the book, it feels like a fully encompassed story. But then I have others where it just feels like it could be a trilogy or a series. Like, it just, I don't know why, but there's like something about, I guess, what the story is.
Yeah.
Most of what I've written has been series. And so anytime I start something new, there's always that potential. And I always kind of leave little breadcrumbs that I could exploit later. But lately I've been kind of shifting my strategy and I want to do a lot more standalone. So I'm trying to purposely not make it open-ended, but old habits die hard. So the book I just finished has a nice lead for a follow-up book. I'm just going to say it's got sequel potential and not call it a series.
I'm curious, why are you moving towards standalone versus series?
Because I want to be, I want the freedom to be able to write different types of books and write new characters and explore new things without being locked in. One of the downsides, it's not really a downside. It actually has a lot of positives. But, you know, one of the things that's, that can sometimes feel a little limiting for, say, my Dan Collier books. I love that character, but I catch myself all the time going shorthand because I don't need to, you know, flesh out his backstory. He's got, you know, 13 books and a bunch of novellas that tell his backstory. But I want this to still be something new readers can discover. So now I have to juggle, like, how much backstory do I still include? And how do I make sure the reader knows that he has this ability or whatever? But I, when I wrote this, this current book, it almost could be a Dan Kotler book, but I have all new characters. Well, the feedback I just got from somebody in the business was that, you know, he loved it. He loved the characters, but he felt like he wasn't connecting as much to them because they didn't have as much complexity. So we're going to talk about that tomorrow. I love that as feedback, but I think that is a result of me having written series so much.
Yeah.
Cool. I mean, I could see that. I think, you know, that's one thing that's always really hard. And I think I learned this, like, you know, there's a lot of shows where it's like, there was definitely a sweet spot to end the series, but then they keep going and it just sort of devolves. And I think that risk also happens in books, you know, where you're reading it. And even if the series is still captivating and good, I do think that there is also reader fatigue. Like, you start getting into that 6+ book series. The readers themselves are a little fatigued by it, even if it's still like they still are into it. But then also it becomes more daunting for new readers because, like, you go on Amazon, right? And you're just like, oh, this new book came out. It's getting all this hype. Oh, wait, I have to read 10. Like, not going to do it. So I think that's also a risk.
Yeah, I think most of my, like, writer craft really built up through serials. And because of that, like, there's that ending arc and beginning your next arc and sort of making the tail ends for when the next story will just keep going. So almost everything I've written has, like, the series potential to it, except one that I intended to write as a standalone, and then everyone wants a sequel for it anyway, and I'm like, okay, fine. But like, I have enough, like, in my head to be like, okay, yeah, this story can continue if I want it to. So I don't know, I think I always view it as, like, you know, you're sort of in that snapshot with their life. And if you want it to continue, you can keep going. And it isn't like the book closes and that's it for me.
Yeah. I just finished writing a standalone, and I've been in the standalone area for a while, even though I started in serials too and did, like, enough for 6 novels. Yeah. I think there are 5 novels out, but I've been thinking about that lately, that I'd like to do a series and trying to think about longevity for that. So I don't know.
I'm kind of becoming an advocate for, you should have a game plan for the entire run of a series if you're going to write series. Yeah. So, like, when I first kind of got started in self-publishing, the first two things I wrote were both trilogies. And I was unprepared for the level of vitriol I would get from certain people who got mad that they were going to have to buy 2 more books. That just floored me. I'm like, you've never heard of Star Wars, or, you know, but what I think that did for me, though, was I had a beginning, middle, and end for that series. You know, it can form its own complete volume.
Yeah.
And it, you know, it made me think about the story more, make sure I'm saying what I want to say. And each time I you know, did that, following that, I, you know, it that really helped shape things. When I started doing the Kotler books, it was always intended to be ongoing. It was going to be my Jack Reacher kind of thing. And, you know, I basically feel like I've told all the stories I can tell. And now I'm just sort of repeating them with new words, or a new artifact, a new map. You know, so I, you know, it's kind of gone a little stale. But had I decided I'm going to write 3 or 4 books in this series, and this is what I feel, by the way, about TV. I think TV should do this. The UK TV does this a lot, where they have basically, you know, 3 series of a show, and then it's done. You know,
except for
Doctor Who, which they've determined they're going to just beat into the ground until it's worthless. But But they, you know, if had they stuck with that model, I mean, it's sad to see those characters go, but you also get the potential of, you know, few years later, you could do a follow-up set of series. And then now you're seeing them further along. And instead of getting tired of them, you anticipate them. So I think that's a good method. I think that's a way to handle storytelling. Do it in threes. I like threes. Do three books, three series.
Except for Wheel of Time. They should have kept going and they didn't.
Oh,
was that 13 books?
13 books and they stopped on season three, but that's fine.
What is that up to? Like 9 billion words at this point and Wheel of Time?
Yeah. It's hard. It's a tricky recipe to do that, to figure out what the ending point is and what works and what doesn't. I did actually really like what she said, though, about how this character, Frankie, even though it's like sort of like that Jack Reacher character, like that there's consequences to her actions, which I thought was actually really interesting. Because I do feel like, especially in those long detective spy, you know, those type of things, like they don't ever really talk about like how traumatic like that line of work is. I really liked that she thought about that and wanted to put that into this character.
No, it was an interesting character, and her protagonist literally has zero skills other than she just likes solving cold cases. So, you know, I thought that was really interesting. So
So she doesn't expect that it's going to be like, you know, she's not going in for like the thrills, or, you know, it's just to provide closure for the family, which I also think is a different angle than a lot of those Jack Reacher type stories. I like that.
Me too. Okay, I guess we should talk about who is up next week. So up next week, it is Jeffrey James Higgins. Jeffrey is a former reporter and retired supervisory special agent who writes thriller novels, short stories, creative nonfiction, and essays. He has wrestled a suicide bomber, fought the Taliban in combat, and chased terrorists across continents. So that is who is up next week. It is Jeffrey James Higgins. That should be a good one. If you'd like to be notified as soon as new episodes publish, make sure you go to writersincpodcast.com and sign up now. We'll see you next episode and have a great week of writing.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Writers Inc. Access the show notes and leave a comment at writersincpodcast.com.